I do want to talk about the impact of CAPTA and the global campaign for high drug prices, and I'm going to focus particularly on what might be driving the pharmaceutical industry to undertake some of the and promote some of the policies that we see in CAPTA, and what the relationship might be to those of us in developed countries. I have no financial conflicts in putting together this presentation. Our question was how the Central America Free Trade Agreement affects access to affordable life-saving drugs for women and families in Guatemala. Okay. Well, that was hopefully the that was one of the questions that we dealt with, and I think there'll be additional information, hopefully, if this is the right presentation that loaded up here. Basically, the point of this slide is that Guatemala is not a source of a great deal of income for the pharmaceutical industry, that accounts for 0.14% of the members of the Pharmaceutical Research Manufacturer Association's annual sales, which is the main association of transnational corporations involved in pharmaceutical research and production. Global pharmaceutical sales are 17 times Guatemala's gross domestic product. 56% of the population of Guatemala are poor. So the question is why Big Pharma is fighting tooth and nail over the drug market in Guatemala. Why is this important? CAFTA establishes strong intellectual property rules and with the promise that this will advance innovation in the discovery of new drugs. Guatemala itself is a major producer of generic drugs for Central America. In terms of women in Guatemala, they are subject to exclusion and discrimination by gender. Why this is important for the United States is that the drugs that I will talk about that are affected by these rules under CAFTA are more commonly used in the U.S. than in Guatemala. CAFTA rules could block policies that we might undertake to provide affordable medicines in the U.S. And certainly we can influence U.S. policymakers both about these policies as they affect both of our countries. So what I want to talk about is the context about what's going on with the pharmaceutical industry and intellectual property, go over some of the information that we've heard about trade agreements and TRIPS, tell you a little bit more about Guatemala, talk about what drugs are protected, and hopefully will be clear to you what I mean by that when we get to that section, and then talk about some recommendations for changes in policy. In terms of the context for the policies that we're going to talk about in the Central America Free Trade Agreement, the pharmaceutical industry for several years has been facing a political crisis. There's an outcry in the U.S., somewhat in other developed countries, but in the U.S. specifically because we have fewer controls over prices, about the high prices that we have to pay. We pay the highest prices in the world, and we are the main source of profits for the pharmaceutical industry. We have faced proposals to re-import drugs from other nearby countries that are basically places where we send our own drugs but have different policies than we have, and therefore countries like Canada have cheaper prices. There have been well-publicized crises in terms of quality control and also crisis in innovation, that there are fewer new drugs being discovered and disseminated, and also, as we know, less research into drugs that are important that may not be blockbuster drugs, and this is true both in developing countries and in developed countries where, for example, we might benefit by new antibiotics. The pharmaceutical industry is the most profitable industry in the world. Despite the defense that these high prices are justified by innovation, very little of the money goes into research and development, about 15%. Most of the money goes into profits, production, and marketing and administration. So there's a three-part political strategy that the pharmaceutical industry has adopted. One is to protect high prices in the U.S. market, to block reimportation in trade language. This is called parallel importation. To seek higher prices in other developed countries, to attack the regimes that are in place in Europe and other countries to control the prices of drugs, and to strengthen the intellectual property structure in regional trade agreements with low and middle income countries, this does allow them to go after a certain substratum of wealthy individuals as well as government funds for drugs. But also these rules that we'll discuss protect their intellectual property regimes in the developing world as well, and does enable them to restrict the sale of generics in developing countries. In terms of intellectual property, one of the mechanisms that we're talking about is patents and what patents do, and we've heard some about this already. Contrary to what trade agreements are supposed to do, which is promote competition to bring down prices, patents protect monopoly rights for originator companies for a given period of time, and intellectual property rules and trade agreements, as we'll talk about in a minute, implement these patent rights. It means that they can sell their products without competition, which of course increases prices. Marketing rights are based on data. So in addition to just granting patents, what originator companies need to do is conduct clinical trials that demonstrate that their products are safe and effective, and they present the data that demonstrates this to regulators. These are expensive trials, and it takes a couple of years to get marketing authority after a patent is granted. Generic drugs don't reproduce these clinical trials, and there are two basic reasons for that. It would be unethical, once we had a drug that we knew worked, to give placebos again to people with a condition who might benefit from the drug. So that's one reason, and the other reason is, of course, it would cost a lot of money. So generic companies that make copies of these drugs rely on the originator's data to prove that their products are safe and effective. They just say our product is bioequivalent, works the same in the body. 65% of U.S. prescriptions are for generic drugs. These copycat drugs are legal after the patent expires, or if there's no patent, or if the country has issued a compulsory license, which we've also heard about. So I'm not going to talk about licenses again. And I'm not going to talk about patents again. And I'm going to talk a little bit about trade agreements. Again, the TRIPS agreement stands for Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Rights. It exists at the level of the World Trade Organization, meaning that all the countries that are members of the WTO have to enact and abide by the terms of the TRIPS agreement. According to the WTO and the TRIPS agreement, all countries, 153 countries in the world at this point, have to give patent holders rights as stated in TRIPS. And we've heard about the Doha Declaration, which gave countries, emphasized the fact that countries can issue these compulsory licenses if they feel that they need to do that on the basis of public health. So the question is TRIPS a floor or a ceiling? In terms of the rights that we have given to pharmaceutical companies, is TRIPS basically as much as they can expect? Certain rules on patents and compulsory licenses, or can we look towards agreements that will give pharmaceutical companies even greater rights, more rights to hold on to their monopoly and deny competition? And the U.S.'s answer to that is that yes, we can use trade agreements to give pharmaceutical companies even greater rights. Developing and emerging countries such as India, China, Brazil, and South Africa don't believe that this is the way to go. So what do these TRIPS Plus rules do? They lengthen patents and they undermine the ability of countries to issue compulsory licenses. And I want to talk about one particular policy today, data exclusivity. And with data exclusivity, often companies won't apply for a patent in a low-income country because it's time-consuming and it costs money. Even though that gives the maximum protection in the longest amount of time, they may just rely on something called data exclusivity. And what data exclusivity is it basically precludes the generic company from pointing to the originator company's data from those clinical trials. Everybody with me? Basically, it says they can't use the originator company's data to go to the regulators and say, we're bioequivalent to them, they've proven what they have to prove, we're just like them, so go ahead and let us register. So that's data exclusivity. It protects the originator's right to the data for a certain period of time. And we don't need to talk about this too too much more. So Guatemala is south of Mexico, close to the United States. It's a very poor country, low GDP, many indexes that show that women are subject to exclusion and discrimination, and high rates of infant mortality and high rates of maternal mortality. Malnutrition is a leading cause of death, and this just shows you some of the leading causes of morbidity and mortality for women. CAFTA and intellectual property. CAFTA grants, again, greater monopoly rights to brand name pharmaceutical companies, which I will suggest make drugs less affordable. There have been transnational corporation campaigns to discredit generics since 1999, even before CAFTA was implemented in 2005. There are government programs for affordable first-line medicines. There's what they call an open contract bidding system that lists drugs that the government will make affordable and lists their prices. Nevertheless, many drugs are still unavailable, and it's increasingly expensive to go through the process of registering drugs in Guatemala. There has been a tug of war in Guatemala over this data exclusivity policy even before CAFTA started being discussed. In 1999, there was the first effort by the pharmaceutical industry to convince the legislature of Guatemala to adopt data exclusivity rules. In 1999 was the first time that data exclusivity was passed, and it was a five-year rule. Basically said pharmaceutical companies can come in and list whatever drugs they want, and they'll be protected for 5 years whether they have a patent or whether they don't. In 2000, they changed that law so that there would be 15 years of data exclusivity. In 2003, the legislature said, no, that's too much, let's make it 5 years. 2004, they repealed data exclusivity completely, and this was as in the lead up to CAFTAs, there was a great deal of civil unrest and resistance. In 2005, they went back to 5 years, and in 2006, they adopted CAFTA, which grants 5 years of data exclusivity. Several of the protected drugs that are listed in Guatemala are, in fact, going off of patent in the U.S. Three of the patented drugs, including Plavix, and there are increasingly and will be more patented substances. There are 77 brand name drugs that have data protection for 5 or 15 years, including 5 protease inhibitors for HIV/AIDS. We also looked through these open contracts, through the list of open contract drugs, we looked to find some evidence of the effect of these rules on prices, and we found that the new drugs introduced under IP rules are targeted to the wealthy. They tend to be, some of them, but not all of them, are clinical improvements over drugs that are already available. And to the extent that there are clinical substitutes available for the protected drugs are, no surprise, more expensive than the drugs that are not protected. So these are just a series of slides talking about our comparisons of the data protected drugs with that are brand name drugs with other drugs that are not data protected. There are 8 data protected brand name drugs on this government list, the open contract list, that the Ministry of Health buys drugs from. All of these data protected brand name drugs are significantly more expensive compared to their therapeutic equivalents that are being sold by the government, available through the government. And these are some sample prices. The statin Crestor used for high cholesterol costs 249% more than a similar drug, the non-data protected fluvastatin. Insulin Lantus, which treats diabetes, costs 846% more than the non-data protected equivalent. An anti-infectant Vifend used to treat fungal infections costs 810% more than its equivalent, and an intravenous antibiotic Invans used to treat pneumonia, which, as you may recall, is a significant problem in Guatemala, costs 342 times more than the non-data protected Marinem. A few more of the characteristics of these data protected drugs. Many of them are blockbuster drugs. I mentioned many of them are going off patent, but many of them are also blockbuster drugs that are protected in Guatemala. In 42 cases, drugs which are protected in Guatemala are no longer data protected in the U.S. or their data protection will expire earlier in the U.S. than in Guatemala. What that means is we will be able to get these drugs generic and generic form at a lower price in the United States earlier than they will be available at an affordable price in Guatemala. And this just goes into some detail about that and the importance of the drugs that are involved. And this lists some of the blockbuster drugs with expiring patents in the U.S., Crestor, Plavix, Cialis, Erbitux, Viagra, and Fusion, which is a drug for HIV/AIDS. And again, this just suggests that part of the motivation for all of this activity is that pharmaceutical companies are planning for fresh challenges in pricing and intellectual property by strengthening their regulatory ability for market control by brand name drugs. And that CAFTA can have a blowback effect to the United States, both because of the direct effect in terms of prices of drugs and also because the effects of the trade agreement in general exacerbates poverty in Guatemala, driving immigration to the U.S., and certainly destabilizes the region. We had a direct experience of the growth of narco-terrorism just south of the border here and some plans that we had to go to Tijuana, and that's certainly, for those of you who have been to Central America recently, a growing phenomenon. Again, the U.S. market is a far more lucrative market for the pharmaceutical industry than is Guatemala. However, sales are dipping in 2008, a reflection of the lack of innovation and new products coming onto the market. We also looked at direct-to-consumer advertising, which I'll get to next. This talks a little bit more about sales and intellectual property. In terms of pharmaceutical advertising, a lot of the drugs that are involved on these lists are also high on the list of drugs that are the subject of direct-to-consumer advertising in the U.S. So what might we do about all this? For one thing, it's important to note that the pharmaceutical industry, having succeeded in implementing these policies in Guatemala, is still not satisfied with the extent of its intellectual property protection there. There's a mechanism called a 301 watch list, which can be implemented by the U.S. trade representative if we feel that our trade partners, back to the issue of cheating or paying attention or abiding by trade agreements, if we feel our trade partners are not adequately living up to the terms of the trade agreements they have signed with us. Guatemala is using a particular law, Decree 16203, to make it more possible for them to import AIDS medicines through the Pan American Health Organization, and the pharmaceutical industry has complained to this. This is a quote from either the pharmaceutical industry or what was or the response from USTR. Despite the entry into force of the DR CAFTA, patent linkage has not yet been fully implemented, and they're relying on this decree 16-2003. So the U.S. Trade Representative has warned Guatemala by putting them on this 301 watch list that we are not pleased with their activities in that regard. So policy recommendations include taking Guatemala off of this 301 watch list, that we would advise the next administration, and I will say both candidates have made better statements on the issue of intellectual property and trade agreements than has the current administration, although at this point Senator Obama has been much more forthright in his statements of intent to revisit our trade policies. But we believe that the administration, even though this language is in the trade agreements, can say that we won't enforce the TRIPS Plus rules, that we should ensure that needed medicines are sold at affordable prices and delivered to CAFTA countries, that we should look at technology transfer programs, which are, again, supposedly the intent of these trade agreements is to encourage innovation. In fact, there's measures of technology transfer that are blocked by CAFTA. We can encourage those. We should remove the TRIPS plus IP provisions from pending agreements with Colombia and South Korea. Some of them have been modified in the agreement that we signed with Peru, but we could do more in that regard. And again, that our trade negotiating objectives should be not just to protect the pharmaceutical industry, but to try to achieve access to affordable medicines and improve health with our trading partners. So our policy choices for the coming year, are to continue with a trade policy that benefits the pharmaceutical transnational corporations or adopt trade policies that protect and improve public health. This is a series of trade objectives that CPATH and APHA and other organizations have signed on to, that in addition to access to affordable medicines, that we would like to see trade policies that encourage sustainable economic development and protect vital human services and domestic regulation of our vital services, encourage our ability, protect our ability to control tobacco and alcohol products. And we think that this is a good starting list of objectives for the next year. We have also worked on increasing public health input into trade advisory committees that advise the U.S. Trade Representative, which is part of the executive branch. This is a slightly outdated list of the companies and the number of their representatives on the advisory committees that have access to the U.S. Trade Representative. We would like to change that picture. The General Accountability Office has looked at both our policies regarding access to medicines and suggested that we could do more, even within the parameters of TRIPS, to protect public health, and has also said that we could do better in terms of including a public health voice. So we invite you to, there actually is a sign-up list going around. Have people seen it? Thank you. If you haven't had a chance to sign up to stay in touch with the APHA Trade and Health Forum, we invite you to sign up on the list. CPATH also has a listserv, which you can join by sending a blank message to that address, and invite everybody to stay in touch with us. Thank you for your attention.
I'd like to invite the presenters to come up to the stage now, and I'm sure they would all be happy to take any questions from any of you. And I believe the microphones that are working, if you choose to use those, or just stand up and speak up. Yes.
My name is Harry Mahmoud from the University of California, San Francisco. And my question is to the one who presented on CSR. I'm doing tobacco research, and CSR programs are always used as cover for the industries to gain credibility. So how does one balance the pace for improving these factory conditions?
This is a really hard problem. I understand that CSR programs are used as covers because, I actually don't know how to answer the question. CSRs are used as covers. They're doing little bits of country, but if you want to improve working conditions in a country, you pressure the government to have regulations and enforce regulations. And that's what I'm interested in. We don't do it in this country. We don't do it in China. So, I don't have any suggestions. I go to our section, the occupational health section, and I talk about how do we get decent regulations and a decent labor movement in the absence of a state, of a government that's actually interested in working conditions. And I continue to wrestle with it. Sorry, I wish I had something brilliant to say, but I don't. Did you want to add something? Life is really cheap, and all those costs are, we call them externalities. Like, the company doesn't pay for ill health because workers' comp costs are offset and they're spread out to all of us, because nobody uses the workers' comp system in this country, and certainly countries like Vietnam and China, they don't have a workers' comp system. And yes, those costs are either are completely externalized. Everybody, they're spread out over everyone. Economic arguments, they're not helping.
So, along the same line,
sure.
I'm wondering, do you see a place for fair trade movement?
Yes.
In this, because I struggle with this. It's like you can buy a lot of fair trade things.
Yes. No, it's really hard. I think it's almost like regulating pesticides or regulating chemicals. You can try to do it chemical by chemical, and it doesn't work. And you need a general policy. Just like we cannot regulate, fair trade, like the whole fair trade thing. It's hard. Okay, so we do it for coffee. Well, what about pens and paper clips and this podium and this cable? I mean, it's just like within 2 feet of me, there's all this stuff that we can't have. We can't rely on consumer movements to protect these things and to protect the rights and working conditions of people who make this stuff and the environmental degradation that results from it. I think it's not the way to go. We need decent government. We need a humane government. Maybe we'll get one here, but we don't produce anything here anymore, so that's a problem. Unless we have green jobs, which is it's the next big thing. It's my next hope. But as far as our production system in general, I'm not optimistic. Yes.
For Ellen, if indeed TRIPS agreements make the price of pharmaceuticals in Guatemala high and the people affected by that are essentially the wealthy, why does the Guatemalan government approve this? I mean, why aren't the wealthy powerful enough in Guatemala to prevent that from happening?
So the theory is that the wealthy in Guatemala would protest this and want cheaper drugs and lean on their government to give them to protect their lower prices. I think that the answers to that are, first of all, that again, I think the government in Guatemala is not necessarily any more representative than ours is, and I guess the question would have to be, how much of a problem is this for wealthy Guatemalans? I mean, there's 4 or, a couple thousand of them. I think there is such, and I'm not as intimately familiar with Guatemala as some people here may be, so I'm speaking a little just from being there and from looking at data, but my sense is that the stratum of people who are above average are pretty well off, and this is not one of their bigger problems. It's not something that they're leaning on the government for, particularly in comparison to what the pharmaceutical industry is doing. And the other thing that I'll just say, I mentioned the campaigns by the transnational corporations in addition to, and we'd like to go back and look and see how this affects the list of data protected drugs. There has been a campaign since 1999 by the transnational corporations against generic drugs, and many people are convinced with some validity that some of the generic, they are convinced that generic drugs in general are worse, and that these that brand name drugs in general are much better. I mean, that is separate from the question of, why do they want to spend 900% more on particular ones. But that's some of the political background that the government has to deal with, and the reality seems to be that some of the locally produced generic drugs meet generic manufacturing standards, the GMP standards that are imposed by the World Health Organizations, and some of them don't. So that's the background to it. But I think it's really a question of the balance of power and how much people care, and I think the pharmaceutical industry has won on that. I don't know if other people have other thoughts. Renee is saying that probably the wealthy own stock in U.S. businesses, and that's of equal or more concern to them, which is a good point. The patent rights aren't particular. No, the patent rights are not all that different in the U.S. from other. The question was, why are patent rights different in the U.S. from other from other countries? And the patent rights are pretty similar, especially where the World Trade Agreement. What is different are the regulations that we've been able to enact regarding price controls. And in other countries, there are much different rules for, well, there are different systems of buying and distributing drugs. There are more public systems for doing that. But even in the private sector, so in the public sector, there are better systems for, you know, reference pricing drugs and having formularies and those sorts of things, which we have a little bit in the public sector here. But there are also price controls in the private sector, and we really don't have those in the United States. And for those of us who watched the argument over the drug benefit in Part D of Medicare, where the government basically said, you know, we're going to give the benefit, but we're not going to negotiate prices. It's those kinds of differences, and our thought is that it's exactly those kinds of regulations that the pharmaceutical industry is very wary of in the United States. Again, other opinions, you all are knowledgeable. Any thought, different thoughts from the panel on these questions? Okay. Mas? Hang on, there's so 1, 2, 3, but please.
I had a question on the topic.
Okay. Did you guys want to follow up on that particular? Ali and Don, did you want to? The agreement was, so we'll do these two and then sort of move on to, we have a couple of more minutes if that's all right with everybody. The Australia, there probably are several, but the one that we first recognized was the agreement with Australia, which we signed in 2004, which had a couple of provisions in it, one that specifically banned reimportation. Another section, Section 2C, that went into all kinds of things that Australia has to do because they do have a public purchasing and pricing system with reference drugs that the pharmaceutical industry really hates because they're another developed country with some money. And then there's a standard section that was obscurely worded, I referred to it in the slideshow, called parallel importation, that basically said you can't do parallel importation, which is trade talk for reimportation of drugs. So the U.S. Trade Representative, Congress read the part that said you can't reimport. There was a lot of public hue and cry about that. The U.S. Trade Representative took that stuff out of there, but they left in the parallel importation language. By the time we read the agreement and said to Congress, hey, look over here, basically it had already been signed. So Congress, and there was a lot of interest in passing that trade agreement for a variety of reasons. So members of Congress who wanted to vote for the agreement basically stood up on the floor of Congress, again, on both sides of the aisle, and said, this is really crummy. And we know, and it could, in fact, apply to Medicaid and other federal programs, and protested and said to the USTR, don't ever do this to us again. And, in fact, they have taken the parallel importation language out of subsequent agreements, and they have been very clear in agreements like Peru and Colombia that they are exempting Medicaid, which certainly is a federal program, from any rules that might affect it. So, but Australia is still in effect, and given the arcane way these things work, who knows? You know, there could be a case at some point. Ali, did you have another question?
I was interested in going to the
Okay. Well, then let me ask this person here who hasn't asked a question. And
I have a question on the same.
So why don't we go that way and that way, because I don't think you've asked a question yet. So
I was just curious how statistics about life expectancy actually work. Usually, the way we see these, the most influential thing is actually infant mortality. But what you're implying is that something really changes
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the life tables would be highly sensitive in calculating life expectancy to infant mortality. A puzzling feature about this mortality crisis was not that it was concentrated in financially sensitive members of the population. So in most epidemics, the elderly the infants, pregnant women are hit hard. This was unique because it was working age men who bore the brunt of the burden. So, a better measure in a publication that's coming out is age standardized working age mortality rates. And you could see in the models that I did across different age groups that it was concentrated in ages 15 to 59.
They
do, but men were disproportionately employed in such large-scale factory industries that were devastated by some of these reforms. And when I break the analysis out by gender, and I didn't have time to go through all of those slides, you do see an impact on women's life expectancy. It just isn't as pronounced as it is for men. Does that answer your great question? Well, it was an interaction, so privatization in settings with higher social capital did better. To tell you the story of the Czech Republic, they implemented a borderline mass privatization program. So they got part of the way there, and civil society, it played out kind of how the reformers expected. The workers and managers opposed the reforms, and they were able to block it halfway through. Now, if you compare Czech Republic to Poland, Poland didn't go as far as the Czech Republic in mass privatization, Czech Republic didn't perform as well as a result. So Russia privatized around 60% in a couple years, where Czech Republic was 25%. But yeah, I think the policy implication of inclusive social policies are really important. I mean, I think any health impact assessment that would have looked at this program before it went down would have seen this as being a really obvious policy, but unfortunately we didn't have HIAs then. And I hope the World Bank and International Monetary Fund will make them part and parcel of all their economic reforms to avoid these types of unintended consequences.
One more.